This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga, and here is what's coming up.
The president had to sort out the political angle to the protest, which was to stop the protest from happening, which had already had started to cannibalize the economy.
That's Silas Omenda, founder of Divergent, a research and data analysis firm for small businesses in Kenya, on how inflation has been fueling dissatisfaction with President William Ruto. Also, Sudan's capital is quiet on a key anniversary in the fight against military rule. And at least 25 villagers are abducted along Cameroon's border with Nigeria. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The situation in Kenya is calm after 2 weeks of opposition anti-government protests. While both sides have decided to give dialogue a chance, President William Ruto has yet to say how his administration will fight the high cost of living, one issue that sparked the demonstrations. From Nairobi, VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has this report.
4 days after President William Ruto and opposition leader Raila Odinga agreed to a temporary truce, some Kenyans have expressed a huge sigh of relief. The protests were paralyzing streets in Nairobi and other major cities and starting to hurt the country's already fragile economy. However, opposition leader Odinga had suggested the protests could resume if the government fails to show meaningful engagement in discussing key issues, such as reforms to address alleged election irregularities. The central issue for many Kenyans is the high cost of living. Silas Omenda, founder of Divergent, a research and data analysis firm for small businesses, says President Ruto needs to give attention to inflation.
The president had to sort out the political angle to the protest, which was to stop the protest from happening, which had already had started to cannibalize the economy. The next conversation is that it becomes now a conversation around economy in terms of what needs to be done to alleviate the current economic crisis.
Omenda says the cost of food and other basic commodities has skyrocketed.
So if you look at 2021, maize, a packet of 2 kgs was going to around 117 Kenyan shillings. If you look at 2022, it went up by around 126, right? Mm-hmm. So that's actually an upwards of around 8% increase, yeah? And food is maize is a staple food in this country.
The Kenyan Bureau of Statistics says the annual inflation rate as measured by the Consumer Price Index was 9.2% in February, a slight increase from January. On the streets of Nairobi, people interviewed by VOA say they want calm while the parties attempt to boost the economy. Frederick Juma said the president deserves support for now.
I want to urge our opposition leader, Mr. Raila, Prime Minister Raila Amolo Odinga, to have the interest of Kenyan at heart and to do dialogue and to come up with a solution that will fit all Kenyans.
Mohamed Hassan Galgalo voiced support for Odinga but wants to see talks between the government and opposition.
Let the people of Kenya give him time. And then 6 months, you cannot do something with 6 months. You want the people of Kenya to give him like 1 year. If 1 year is not going to do anything, now you are going to start to judging.
Vincent Kimosop, a policy and governance expert in Nairobi, told VOA it's true the cost of living is high, but it's important to recognize there are several issues.
Number one, top line issues at the moment politically is the reconstitution of the electoral management body. And I can tell you at this point, for observers like us, I've just come from a meeting, it will be very critical to ensure that the issues that affect the public continues to be part of the conversation, which are raising high cost of living, the issues of youth unemployment. Number three, the issues of consolidating national unity and cohesion. And you know, these issues were identified way back, even in the mediation process that Kofi Annan chaired in 2000 2007.
Former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan led a group of mediators following a bitterly disputed presidential election between Odinga and former President Mwai Kibaki that resulted in Odinga serving a term in the now abolished post of prime minister. Meanwhile, the opposition's deadline for meaningful engagement is set to expire Sunday. Odinga has not said if the protests would resume the following day. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
The streets of Sudan's capital were deserted today as the civilian opposition prepared protests to mark an anniversary in the fight against military rule. The French news agency AFP says authorities declared it a non-working day and deployed a large military presence on the streets. Troops also blocked off the Nile bridges leading to the suburbs of Khartoum. April 6th is a symbolic date marking the anniversaries of uprisings in 1985 and 2019 that ousted two leaders who had taken power by force. Current leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhani staged a coup against the civilian-led government in October 2021. Today, the opposition and military were scheduled to sign a deal to restore a transition to democracy, but the signing was delayed amid tensions within the military over the timetable for reintegrating and the powerful paramilitary rapid support forces into the regular army. Security forces in Cameroon are searching for at least 25 villagers that gunmen abducted along its border with Nigeria. Locals are calling on the government to stop armed gangs operating on both sides of the border. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Officials in Cameroon say unidentified gunmen abducted the villagers during daily attacks and looting this week in Akko district on its western border with Nigeria. District officials say several hundred villagers fled from the attacks. Akko's mayor, Kanyan Kwai, says the unidentified gunmen operate on both sides of the porous Cameroon-Nigeria border. He spoke to VOA from Akko via a messaging application.
25 people have been kidnapped so far. We fear that more may have been kidnapped because since Monday, we have not been able to reach out to people at Buku, Abafum, and Kwancha border entry point far into Nigeria. And no message has come from the kidnappers to let us know why they are doing this. We don't know if those who have been kidnapped are killed. We don't know if they are alive.
Cameroon's military says it has deployed troops along the border with Nigeria to rescue those abducted and stop the gunmen. The Membe Cultural and Development Association is a Cameroonian aid group helping villagers along the border with Nigeria. President of the group, Abel Shewa, says the attackers are displacing scores of villagers every day, most of them women and children. He also spoke to VOA from Akko via a messaging application.
Most of the villages have been abandoned as the population flee into Nigeria and to Akko town for safety. So we are pleading with humanitarian organizations to intervene, to come in and assist the population displaced from their homes. And now they don't have what to live on. Women and children are suffering and the entire civilian population is affected and people are living in total fear.
Shewa called on Cameroon's government to provide aid to the displaced and pleaded with host communities to also offer them food and shelter. Local officials tell VOA they suspect the abductors are ethnic Fulani herders from Nigeria. Officials say the herders seasonally cross into Cameroon with their cattle for grazing, leading to conflict with farmers. Cameroon's border villages have also suffered attacks by Islamist militants from Nigeria, such as the Boko Haram group. But this is the first time in more than a decade that officials suspect a large-scale attack by Fulani herders, a nomadic people scattered across Western and Central Africa. Cameroon's military created a border post in Bauru village in 2012 after violent clashes between Nigerian Fulani herders and Cameroonian farmers over land rights. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Mozambique has legalized the creation of local militias under the military to help fight Islamist militants in the northern Cabo Delgado province. Charles Mangwiro reports from Maputo, Mozambique.
The decree legalizing the involvement of local militias in the fight against Islamist militants in the northern province of Cabo Delgado was approved and announced Wednesday after a cabinet meeting in Maputo late that day. The government had secured parliamentary approval for the move in November after the defense ministry admitted the Mozambican army could not deal with militias alone. The self-defense local militias already help the Mozambican armed forces and military contingents from Rwanda and some Southern African Development Community countries in the fight in oil-rich Cabo Delgado. Cabinet spokesman Filima Oswazi says the local militia force will be formalized to strengthen the role of the defense and security forces in countering and containing the spread of militant Islamist incursions, protecting community settlements and public and private infrastructures. He added that the decree will allow for better structuring, organization and logistical support for local self-defense militias. Swazi says the decree establishes the local force and the respective statute. He says the decree defines the concept of the local force, its activation and deactivation, composition, forms of acquisition and its rights and duties. The force is mostly composed of ex-combatants and civilians who, since 2020, have supported the fight in Cabo Delgado. In 5 years, the conflict in Cabo Delgado has already displaced more than 1 million people, according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and caused close to 5,000 deaths, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, which specializes in disaggregated conflict data collection, analysis, and crisis mapping. Mozambique has been fighting militants linked to the Islamic State group in Cabo Delgado since 2017. Charles Mangwiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A new report says at least 401 human rights defenders were killed in 26 countries in 2022, based on statistics from human rights organizations. Olive Moore, interim director of the Ireland-based group Frontline Defenders, tells VOA's Caravan Dam these are targeted killings and it's not just humanitarian aid workers.
It's people who we would not normally perhaps think of when we think of human rights defenders, and local indigenous women living very rurally who are trying to protect the local river that may be polluted by transnational companies, and lawyers who are going to court and standing up for other human rights defenders. Essentially, these are individuals who can be regular individuals like you or me who are stepping up for their communities, who are stepping up for their families, and who are challenging injustice all around the world.
Of the 401 people killed last year, were a sizable number of those human rights defenders in Africa? And if so, can you describe what countries in Africa we're talking about?
Yeah, 20 of those human rights defenders were from countries in Africa. So, I mean, the first country where we saw the highest number of killings in Africa was DRC, where, of course, there's a conflict where we saw 8 defenders who were killed for their work. South Africa, 5 human rights defenders killed, many of them from social movements that were trying to advocate for housing rights, for better conditions for those who were living in slums. And then other countries such as Sudan, for example, also 3 human rights defenders. Kenya, different places. The vast majority of human rights defenders that are killed are from the Americas, but unfortunately it's a trend that we see all around the world in all continents where human rights defenders are targeted because of their work.
Where in the world is it the most dangerous for these human rights defenders?
Colombia, absolutely without a doubt, Colombia. And this is something we've seen for many years now. We have tracked 401 human rights defenders all around the world who've been killed. And of those, nearly half of those are in one country, in Colombia.
Why in Colombia?
I think Colombia is a country that has experienced conflict for many decades. We had the peace accords in the last couple of years, but certainly within rural areas and remote areas of Colombia, it's still an extremely dangerous place to be. Where the state doesn't have much of a presence, and where human rights defenders, where communities, where families, where people are caught between paramilitaries and the state.
What would you say? Are things getting better or worse overall with these defenders of human rights?
I think things are getting worse, and this is what human rights defenders are telling us, what they're seeing on the ground. It's really hard to say this empirically, because of course we only know, for example, when we say 401 human rights defenders were killed last year, we know this is underreported. There are countries, for example, we can only verify killing two human rights defenders in Afghanistan last year, but we know there were many, many more human rights defenders killed.
Back to Africa, I saw in your report that the main types of threats that you're looking at on the continent there is detentions and arrests. Can you just elaborate a little bit on that?
So this is what we see as criminalization. So one of the most effective ways of closing down civil society space and closing down the work of human rights defenders is to target them through the courts, is to threaten them or to target them with arrest, threaten them with detention. And so what it is spurious charges being made against human rights defenders. And increasingly, one of the things we're seeing is the use of counterterrorism. And this is abuse of counterterrorism, where, for example, they will be charged with working against the state. That's one area where we certainly see quite often. Another area would be around perhaps they will be charged with fraud. And again, these are all illegal, spurious charges which are made against defenders, which do two things. First of all, it takes all of their time and resources. And of course, if these charges, which often is the case when you run through long court cases and the charges are upheld, defenders are then imprisoned. So this is across the board criminalizing defenders.
That's Olive Moore, interim director of the international rights group Frontline Defenders. She was speaking with my colleague Carl Van Dam from Dublin, Ireland.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Some of Zimbabwean officials accused of gold smuggling and money laundering in the Al Jazeera documentary Gold Mafia have welcomed the government plan to investigate the allegations. But critics doubt the government's ability to crack down on internal corruption. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, Zimbabwe.
In March, Al Jazeera released its investigative documentary Gold Mafia, which linked illegal gold trade and corruption to powerful individuals in Zimbabwe. Simon Radland is a businessman who owns a tobacco company. In the documentary, he was accused of lending the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe millions of dollars to buy gold to be smuggled out of the country. He dismissed the Al Jazeera film, describing it as sensationalized in the extreme and making broad claims without any context or evidentiary proof. However, he told VOA he welcomed government investigations into the documentary's claims. But this financial officer at a government school who chose to be unidentified because of fears for his safety says he has provided evidence of corruption to authorities over the past 3 years and is doubtful anything will happen to the gold mafia.
I don't foresee them acting on this issue of corruption. Yeah, was given the number of times, apart from the submission of the physical documents. I've even had instances of actually making calls to follow up, and at times they sound like they've forgotten about who this person is calling over which issue.
The Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission turned down requests for interviews about the accusations in the Gold Mafia documentary. But following the film's release, Zimbabwe Information Minister Monica Mchangwa said the government was taking measures.
Government takes this opportunity to reaffirm its commitment to upholding local and international laws, including laws relating to financial transactions, the trade of gold, and the other precious minerals of our country.
But Tendai Biti, an opposition leader and former Zimbabwe finance minister, does not think so.
The Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission has spent millions, about $33 million in the last year alone, on corruption, but there's been no prosecution, there has been no investigation. So we have no confidence in that anything can happen, but at least we welcome the normative commitment to dealing with corruption.
The Zimbabwean government has long been accused of ignoring corruption associated with senior officials from the ruling ZANU-PF party. Critics say that explains why the country's economy is in doldrums. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
On VOA Africa Radio, we let the sound tell you the story. News, sports, science, and entertainment available to you 24/7. Tune in on your local FM stations. We are also available on the medium waves, 909 kilohertz and 1530 kilohertz. Our short waves are 6080, 15580, 4930, 15165, 15580, and 17530 kilohertz. VOA Africa, your trusted source for news and information.
Tunisian President Kais Saied said today the country would reject what he called foreign diktats from the International Monetary Fund. The IMF's talks with the government over a bailout package have stalled. The French news agency AFP reports that Saied told reporters the IMF demands will lead to more poverty and are unacceptable. His government and the IMF had reached a preliminary agreement in October for a nearly $2 billion package, but the IMF's board has not given final approval. The international lender is pushing for the removal of state subsidies on basic goods, particularly fuel, and is calling for the restructuring of more than 100 state-owned and heavily indebted companies that hold a monopoly on the economy. AFP says the IMF is partially dependent on its sister lender, the World Bank, which has suspended loans to Tunisia after Saied made incendiary comments against migrants from sub-Saharan Africa. Saied says an alternative to the international institutions, Tunisians should, in his words, work on our own. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbio Yabro, and our engineer, Idris Regis, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM stations.